This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. What an incredible week it has been. Tuesday's election and the ensuing days of counting. Then came waiting for results from Michigan, Wisconsin, then Nevada and Arizona, and finally Georgia, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. It has been a world of tension, but also in some sense, predictable. Donald Trump's election night edge in some of those states slowly eroded as officials tallied up mail-in ballots that tended to favor Joe Biden. And that was the red mirage scenario that many reporters and analysts had been predicting all along. And nearly from the start of things, Joe Biden led in the popular vote. Susan Glasser is a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Susan, I'm reaching you on a Friday morning, and a few states still have not been called definitively. But now with Biden ahead in Pennsylvania and Georgia, we've got to assume that Joe Biden is going to hit that 270 mark. Now, your column is called Letter from Trump's Washington. You've been writing it throughout. What is the mood inside Trump's inner circle?
Donald Trump is someone who avoids reckonings. He's done so his entire life. He has managed to escape from so many previous situations where it looked like disaster, loss was imminent, bankruptcies. And, it appears that he's finally hit a moment of true decision about whether to follow through on his threats. And I think you're starting to see already the cracks, the seams, the fissures in this inner world. One thing we know about Washington and about power generally is that it ebbs very quickly. And, you will see some Republicans going public with their disagreements, as they already are with the president. And this is, for a man obsessed with loyalty, this is kind of the ultimate test right now. So I think you'll see a lot of recriminations spilling out into public.
So we've seen those two press conferences early in the morning after election night, and then again on Thursday. They might have been, in the long history of Trump's speeches, press conferences, and statements, the most dangerous, the most anti-democratic statements from any president of the United States that I've ever read about or experienced.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, Donald Trump all along has been sort of a worst case scenario for American democracy. And I think when we saw him follow through in his threats, the thing that was so painful was the sort of slow motion car crash aspect of this. When somebody tells you they're going to smash the car and then they do it, it's still a terrible car crash. And watching the president do what he'd threatened to do for months, which is call the election rigged and stolen with no evidence. Seeing him do that, we don't know yet what the cost to American democracy is of having a president who has led millions and millions of fellow Americans to distrust the basic pillars of, the democracy. But we know there is a consequence to that. And it was a scary moment, too.
Now, what cards has he got left to play? Let's assume that Joe Biden has gone over the top, or he will very soon. What cards does Donald Trump have left to play, either legally or in the remaining days of his presidency?
Well, look, David, I do think that, you know, this is the peril of our system. A president who is defeated but not gone, and who is a kind of president like Donald Trump is a great risk factor, because we imbue the executive with such power and authority. You know, he has the authority to pardon his friends, his family, even potentially himself. He has talked about firing potentially the director of the FBI and the Secretary of Defense. These are, you know, perhaps our two most key domestic and international security positions. So I think you're going to see this drama of the election results itself fade to a certain extent, right? We'll see in the next few days whether Trump gives in to the pressure he will surely start to feel. I doubt it. You know, for now, they're saying he won't concede. But then the scrutiny will turn to what he can do between now and January 20th in terms of the executive branch, in terms of making changes that could undermine, you know, sort of the will of Congress or the will of the people that we've just seen.
You said earlier that in Washington, power ebbs away very quickly after an election in particular. And yet he has bent the Republican Party to his will all along. There is no one else in the Republican Party, even now after a loss, that can easily replace him. There are all kinds of people down the line you can imagine. But Trumpism, am I right, Susan, will persist even after Trump leaves the Washington area?
Well, Trumpism, it depends what your definition is. There's no question that he has shown the power of this kind of right-wing, populist, nationalist demagoguery. And that force awakened in the land, you know, is not easily put down. You know, there's lots of talk here in Washington spread by Trump and his advisors quite liberally around the town, you know, that he will think about running again in 2024. You saw his sons and his former campaign manager, Brad Parscale, on Thursday, literally threatening Republican officials, saying, if you ever want to win your reelection 4 years from now, you better speak up and defend Trump right now. Color me a bit skeptical. I think that Donald Trump, there's a reason he's tried his whole life to escape the label of loser. It's a stench that covers someone in his view. And I think he's not wrong in that. And so my own sense is that the man himself may find himself not able to exert as much power as the years go on. And he's gone from the Oval Office. But I do believe that his style of campaigning, and there will be a fierce competition that we're already seeing in the Republican Party to lay claim to the mantle of Trumpism and to fight for his hardcore voters. And you already see that in terms of who responded to the Trump brothers' call yesterday. You saw Ted Cruz respond. You know, you saw Tom Cotton respond. You saw, to a certain extent, Nikki Haley respond. They're fighting for the remnants of Trump's voters as opposed to Trump per se.
Let's talk about the establishment on Capitol Hill. Democrats lost some seats in the House, and it's not likely that they want a majority in the Senate. So is Nancy Pelosi gone?
Soon. Not yet. Not yet.
Yeah.
There's no obvious person to take her on. I do think that, you know, the immediate emotionalism around the still unresolved presidential election. So you have, you know, House Democrats on this call that leaked, you know, kind of yelling at each other and crying, and, you know, the centrists, you know, pleading with the left wing of the party, saying, you're killing us here. Will you shut up about defunding the police? If you want to be a majority, you got to act like one. We'll see how Pelosi handles that. That's a significant challenge, but she's been counted out many, many times before.
She sure has. And she in the last couple of years, she showed her steel.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, she was the one who was the de facto leader of the Democratic Party in the Trump era. And I think a lot of people are very grateful to her for that, and showed, enormous resolve at a time when others didn't.
The New Yorker's Susan Glasser. Thanks so much, Susan.
Oh, David, great to talk with you.
This is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list, okay? It's a very sad moment.
While Washington tries to sort out the balance of power, this week the Trump campaign repeatedly engaged a signature Donald Trump move. Let's file lawsuits, as many as possible. It's a fact that Donald Trump has been a party to thousands of lawsuits in the course of his business career and in politics. Memorably, in some cases, the president's campaign asked for the counting of ballots to stop. Jeannie Sook-Gerson is a professor at Harvard Law School and a contributing writer to The New Yorker. Jeannie, good morning. Now, is there any likelihood that this ends up, as Donald Trump keeps saying, in the Supreme Court? I mean, he's setting up a sense of drama reminiscent of the year 2000, Bush v. Gore, but on a multi-state or interstate conspiracy level.
Yes. Well, there is, of course, Bush v. Gore, which was really about recounts. It was about the recount in Florida. And so if there is recount litigation, which Donald Trump could well bring in multiple states this time, it won't be just a Florida or one state situation. It could be multiple fronts of recount litigation. That could end up being appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. Whether the Supreme Court would take one of those cases is getting less and less and less likely as it seems clearer that Biden will have a comfortable victory, even though the margins in each of the states that he needs would be razor thin. I do think that it soon will be time, perhaps not exactly right now, but very soon will be time to move beyond the litigation issues around election day and election vote counting, because we have to remember that there are several hurdles to clear, major ones, before Biden is actually the president of the United States. We have the choice of electors in all the different states, the appointment of electors by the states themselves based on the vote of the citizenry. And we have the meeting of the electors to actually cast their votes for their candidate. And then after that, we also have Congress, which has to agree on the result based on counting the electoral votes.
You seem more concerned about that.
I am concerned about it because of the groundwork that has been laid for months and increasingly and more intensely in the past days about fraud. And that claim of wide-ranging fraud in all of these different races, and then probably there will soon be claims of fraud that are a bit more focused on the states that will tip the balance. And those claims could translate by the Republican Party into claims that it shouldn't be counted in Congress, that Congress should disregard certain votes.
Let me be clear. What you're saying is that the Electoral College itself and its electors could somehow put a real spanner in the works here when it comes to the election of Joe Biden.
What I'm saying is that even if everything were to go smoothly after today in the selection of electors by each of the states, you know, based on the vote by the citizenry, even were that to go smoothly, and then we had a slate of electors in each of the states that reflects what the voters did, even at that point, on January 6th, when Congress is supposed to count the electoral votes, there could be a claim of fraud, an allegation of fraud that is mounted by the president. And if Congress, members of Congress, do not simply ignore it, if they decide to take it seriously, and it turns out that some members of Congress or significant members want to discount the votes for Joe Biden, particularly the ones that put him over the edge, then we might have a situation where Congress itself cannot agree as to who has won the election.
What happens if Congress can't agree? It seems that we would be in a state of chaos, unprecedented chaos.
We would be in a state of chaos if Congress could not agree on who won the election. But it would not be an unprecedented chaos because we did have the election of 1876, where Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden were in a presidential race. This happened in Congress. Congress could not agree as to who had won the election because three states sent electors from both parties to Congress to be counted. And so there was a bit of an impasse. There was a big impasse. And that was a constitutional crisis because the Constitution did not clearly lay out a roadmap for how to proceed from there. So we know we have that precedent. So we know that this time, if Congress cannot agree on who won the election, then we could see something similar to what happened there, which is that Congress appointed a commission to hash it out. And ultimately, we do know that Hayes became the president of the United States.
Do you think it'll go that far?
I don't think that it will, but I do think that there's a significant possibility that it will go that far.
A chilling thought. The New Yorker's Jeannie Sook Gerson, and we heard from Susan Glasser. In a moment, we'll look at what's happening in the Biden campaign with Evan Osnos. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Only three presidential campaigns in the past have defeated an incumbent president. When it's finished, God willing, we'll be the fourth.
Evan Osnos has spent many months over the last year speaking with Joe Biden and many of the people around him about his race for the presidency. I called up Evan to check in on what's next for the former vice president and who seems to be the president-elect. So right now, Friday morning, it looks like Joe Biden is likely to be president. What's been the campaign strategy over the last week? Because it has been a week like no other.
Well, as soon as it was clear how close this was going to be, their strategy was obvious to them, which was to begin to make the case for the math, to say, in effect, no matter what Donald Trump says or does, we see where this is going. We're not stating victory before it's official, but this is not a process we don't understand. And the Biden campaign took a pretty strong lesson from what happened in 2000, when in the disputed election of Al Gore and George Bush, they allowed themselves to be drawn into the appearance of a dispute. And in this case, what the Biden campaign wanted to do from minute one was to dispute the idea that there was even a dispute here. Because, in fact, it was proceeding in an orderly way. And they didn't want to allow the notion of uncertainty to be introduced by Donald Trump. And from the beginning, they've been trying to strike a balance of projecting a sense of inevitability, but not being presumptuous, meaning they're going to talk about the fact that they are moving along with transition in a peaceful way, but they're not yet naming cabinet members and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you heard Jeanne Sook Gerson tell us that she fears that this could spill over into the chaos of 1876, that as chaotic and incoherent as these core challenges may seem to be, it could be challenged by the Electoral College itself and by Congress.
Well, that would be a strategy that's totally consistent with Donald Trump's approach to the law. Let's remind ourselves. I mean, his central theory of jurisprudence comes from Roy Cohn, his late lawyer and mentor, who used to say, after all, I don't care what the law is, tell me who the judge is. So if this becomes essentially a fight at the juncture between the court of public opinion and Congress, the approach that the Biden campaign will take is to say, we understand how this process goes because the Constitution tells us how it goes. This is not a matter of persuasion and dispute. And, you know, there's a very telling moment in these key early days. You remember when Donald Trump came out into the White House and gave his, I think, most unhinged speech, in which it was sort of one series of fabrications after another about election fraud and so on. What did the Biden campaign do in response? Nothing. They did not respond. They let the networks cut away. They allowed this idea, essentially this kind of fantasy of Donald Trump's, to play itself out. President Obama, in his appearance, said, if your neighbor was acting this way, you would worry about your neighbor. This is not normal behavior. And what they're trying to do is not insult the nearly 70 million Americans who've cast ballots for Donald Trump, but they want to sequester Trump's comments and his increasingly, let's call it what it is, delusional perception.
Yeah, but fair enough. But who's going to be with Trump in the end? I mean, is the Republican Party going to abandon Trump now that they see the votes, or are they just going to coalesce around him and act as a kind of, I don't know what to call it, suicide mission or worse?
I think that's why it is, in some ways, it's even more important to listen to what other Republican leaders are saying than what Donald Trump is saying or what Joe Biden is saying. Because remember, other than Donald Trump, frankly, Republicans had a pretty good week and they gained seats in the House. They may or may not have held on to the Senate. And there are reasons why, if you listen very closely to what somebody like Mitch McConnell is saying, he's talking about, okay, let's begin the process of setting the table for policy, talking, sort of leaking to the press the idea that they're going to try to contain Biden's cabinet choices so that they're not as progressive as they might be.
You think Mitch McConnell is moving on from Donald Trump?
I would never underestimate Mitch McConnell's capacity to change course here. He's reading the public. He's reading where he thinks this is going. But Mitch McConnell has his interests at the center, and his interests are what the Congress is going to be able to do. And you hear this active debate around the edges of the Republican Party leadership right now about who is going to hitch their wagon to Donald Trump and who is beginning to part ways with him and let his wagon go over the cliff.
Yeah,
and
I think Lindsey Graham seems to have hitched himself to the wagon.
And not a huge surprise. I mean, look, there is not at this point a clear consensus from the Republican leadership about what they're going to do. That's why they're the ones to watch. My point is, I think that to assume that the Republican leadership in Congress sees its interests as utterly intertwined with Donald Trump's is probably to misread some of their own incentives here. And there may come a point when they decide, all right, let's go into plan B. we're not there yet.
How is Biden and his team planning to handle Donald Trump if in the, well, possible likelihood that the president becomes increasingly erratic in these next few weeks and even few months?
Well, they're projecting the message, as one Biden advisor said to me this morning, that Donald Trump should be worried most right now about Tish James, the attorney general of New York. In effect, what they're saying is Donald Trump can rage against the fates here and pretend that he got more votes than he did. But actually, the electoral math is clear, and Donald Trump should be thinking about life after the presidency. Now, look, there is a degree of bluff here, obviously, because there is all of the full range of potential legal and political disaster. But, you know, at a certain point, what they're trying to avoid doing is allowing themselves to get sucked into this vortex of uncertainty and chaos that Trump is seeking to convey. And so in a way, what they're trying to do is maintain this posture of what I would describe as sort of vigilant reassurance, saying this need not be crazy unless Donald Trump makes it crazy, but we will not have to respond by being as crazy.
The New Yorker's Evan Osnos in Washington. Thanks a lot, Evan.
Thanks, David.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count the votes that came in late, we're looking at them very strongly, but a lot of votes came in late.
Power can't be taken or asserted. It flows from the people. And it's their will that determines who will be the president of the United States, and their will alone.
One of the enduring questions of this election and of the entire Trump presidency over the past 4 years has been about the integrity of our democracy. Can it endure under the stresses that have been placed on it? And what about the lack of confidence from citizens across the political spectrum? I reached out to Amy Davidson Sorkin, who writes about politics for the magazine. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Now, throughout this campaign, Donald Trump has sought to undermine the integrity of the process. He made no secret about it. He basically told us what he was going to do from the start. What kind of lasting damage do you think this might have?
You know, it's profound. But how lasting it is something we're going to decide. You know, there's no answer to that right now. But at the same time, I'll say that the depraved reaction, really, if there's no other word, on the part of some of Trump's prominent supporters, you know, Sean Hannity, it's quite shocking. And of course, Trump's own attempts to just send the message that our elections can't be trusted, that a legal vote is a vote for him, an illegal vote is a vote against him. That is dangerous. And this is a hazardous time. This is a hazardous moment. And it can go a couple of different ways. And a lot of that depends on how Republican elected officials react.
Amy, what does political normalcy look like from here on out?
Political normalcy first is going to be everybody agreeing who won this election. Everybody minus Donald Trump. It's a reminder that we have options in a democracy. We get to vote. We get to change it. We have a terrible president, and then we have an election. You know, that's the most base level normalcy. What normalcy is going to look like in terms of actually getting policy done, getting legislation through, that's another question. Keep in mind that we don't know yet who's going to control the Senate. The Democrats still have a shot of control of the Senate if they somehow won two Senate seats that are going to a runoff in Georgia. Otherwise, you know, if the Republicans win one of those two seats, they'll have control of the Senate. That's probably going to be the most expensive pair of Senate races in history. And, you know, it's going to look very abnormal for the next couple of months in that sense, or at least we'll see how abnormally distorted by money our elections have become as we see how much pours into Georgia, as we see like the rhetoric that's going to surround those two races, that's going to be a reminder of the things that we've come to accept as normal in our elections that are really not healthy.
Donald Trump does not respond well to humiliation. How do you read the risks to the country between now and January 20th?
I feel like the country is going to be paying a price a lot for Trump working up material for his post-presidential rallies. You know, his narcissism, his selfishness is really extraordinary. The idea that he, even when it's clear that he's lost, will be able to show any sort of restraint in leaving in a way that's dignified even. You know, this is a man who loves pomp, who loves ceremony, but that's not the same as dignity, although I think he's mistaken one for the other. So let's see. I mean, the Biden campaign said this morning that, you know, there are ways to remove trespassers from the White House. And whatever you think of that statement or that scenario, it's important to remember that the presidency is not just about Donald Trump saying he's president. It's not about people like him getting a band to play Hail to the Chief, even if he's, you know, been thrown out of office. We have an actual government here that has actual mechanisms. And it sure doesn't look like he's going to be able to seize power in any sort of way. It's, you know, the Republicans are maybe disgracing themselves by feeding his fantasies that this is all like a, you know, a rigged election. But are they going to do that if he won't leave the White House after the Electoral College is met? I that's hard to imagine at this point.
Do you think, Amy, that there's a future to Trumpism? And what is it?
You know, that is absolutely the case. We've talked so far about, you know, our democracy, our Constitution, its mechanisms. That's different than the real political crisis that I think endures with Trumpism. A lot of people who are ideologically close to Trump were elected to Congress. They're in the Senate. They're in the country. He did pretty well in a lot of the country. But a crisis for the Democratic Party is different than a crisis for democracy. When he's off stage, still railing, still pushing, you know, if candidates in the Republican Party go to him for their blessing or think they need him to get elected, this is a crisis about who we are. It's a crisis of character. But the question is whether it's a crisis that's contained within our still solid constitutional framework and mechanisms. You know, it's not that he's not trying. You know, it's not that people around him aren't talking about, you know, states renouncing their electors. But we're a long way from that right now. We're at a place where we're likely going to have a President Biden and some really extreme things said in Congress, extreme governors elected. And that's something we've got to work on really hard. But, you know, I think that soon we may be able to say this election worked.
The New Yorker's Amy Davidson Sorkin. We also heard today from Evan Osnos, Jeannie Sook Gerson, and Susan Glasser. Our conversations took place on Friday morning. You can find our coverage of the election at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. To put the political upheaval that we're living through into a wider context, I often find myself turning to Jill Lepore. Jill is a staff writer and a professor of history at Harvard, and she's also the author of These Truths, a great one-volume history of the United States. Earlier this year, she published an essay called In Every Dark Hour, and she considered how our nation responded the last time that it seemed that democracy was in trouble all around the world.
In the 1930s, you could count on the Yankees winning the World Series, dust storms plaguing the prairies, evangelicals preaching on the radio, Franklin Delano Roosevelt residing in the White House, people lining up for blocks for scraps of food, and democracies dying from the Andes to the Urals to the Alps. American democracy, too, staggered, weakened by corruption, monopoly, apathy, inequality, political violence, hucksterism, racial injustice, unemployment, even starvation. We do not distrust the future of essential democracy, FDR said in his first inaugural address, telling Americans that the only thing they had to fear was fear itself. But there was more to be afraid of, including Americans' own declining faith in self-government. What does democracy mean? NBC Radio asked listeners. Do we Negroes believe in democracy? W.E.B. Du Bois asked the readers of his newspaper column. Could it happen here? Sinclair Lewis asked in 1935. Americans suffered and hungered and wondered.
Jill, in your essay, you're describing a time when Americans and people all over the world were really questioning the future of democracy. What was going on that was making Americans so nervous? A familiar feeling, but so nervous about the democratic process.
It was witnessing new democracies fail. So at the end of the First World War, a whole lot of new democracies had been born when European empires had been broken up. And it was exciting and riveting, and there was a sense of triumph, that early 20s sense of triumph that markets were soaring, people were getting wealthier, democracies were thriving, and it all seemed to fall apart. And by the time you get to the 1930s, the beginning of the Depression, of course, it's much worse and much more perilous because the staggering needs of mass society seemed in many parts of the world to just be not addressable by majority rule, that there needed to be a strongman who could rescue starving populations from their suffering.
So this was a period of enormous uncertainty for democracy, and Americans themselves had a lot of questions about what democracy meant and how it should work. And the solution, you suggest to some extent, was to talk.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, a lot of Americans were swayed by communism and by fascism. I mean, there's a huge range of political opinion and all kinds of new political activity in the United States in the 1930s, political experiments. But in many ways, in response to the attractions of forms of political extremism, Americans who did believe in democracy really fought for it by trying to rekindle its spirit.
Well, I want to play a clip from something called America's Town Meeting of the Year.
Town meeting tonight. Town meeting tonight. What does democracy mean? Town meeting tonight.
This is this completely goofy. I mean, I think I just sort of warn listeners. This sounds really corny. So you either love this stuff or you don't love this stuff. It was a national radio broadcast. It started in 1935, and it was enormously successful. So they would hold these debates in a lecture hall. They'd bring in like 1,000 people, sometimes more, and they'd bring to the stage a few different people, a panel of maybe 4 or 5 people. It wasn't like a one-on-one debate. I mean, they called it a debate. It's more of a panel or a symposium. And they'd have these big questions, you know, should the United States have universal health insurance? And they'd bring in half the people on the panel would agree and half would disagree.
No more appropriate place could be found for a discussion of the subject, what does democracy mean, than our own town hall in New York City, the home of America's town...
In the early American town meetings, a majority of all citizens of a community used to meet together and determine where to build the new schoolhouse, how to run the new road, and what to do about Widow Jenkins' obstreperous cow. Is it possible to conceive of self-government today in those terms? What then does democracy mean under present conditions?
In that sense, democracy for the first time is really being tried. Democracy for the first time is really being tested.
Now for the questions. We'll take the man in the balcony there.
Mr. Hathaway stated that the democracy he expects is the democracy that will permit this present capitalist class to bring in socialism peacefully. Don't you think that the working class, Mr. Hathaway, would do very well to drop any nonsense of any possibility of bettering its conditions under this present system of society and listen to the message of the Socialist Labor Party, the only revolutionary organization in the United States?
What I'm struck by listening to it is like the sense that people had in the 1930s that they were really on the precipice of a history, that democracy was new, as that announcer said. Like, historically, like democracies had only begun with the United States in 1776, and but what they really do accomplish a lot of these conversations is really bringing in ordinary people. I mean, you just really do get the sense when you listen to them or when you read debates, accounts of debates that are going on in, you know, town libraries and in school buildings that are opened up at night for debates, political debates, that, you know, your kind of basic farmer is there, your union worker is there, then, you know, the nurse from the hospital is there, the librarian is there. And people are really kind of dedicating themselves, kind of struggling with working their way through these really big questions. I mean, think about the suffering of the Depression. I mean, everyone was vulnerable to complete economic collapse, no matter where you stood. Just you could fall really fast, and people saw one another falling really fast. And so what was going to hold people up? Well, you were going to have to hold each other up.
Jill, I understand you want to play another clip, which might be more familiar to our listeners.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote.
Well, I think some people at least will recognize that this is a clip from Orson Welles' famous apocalyptic radio drama, The War of the Worlds. But I have got to say, it's not the direction I thought we were heading in. How does this relate to discussions about democracy that were going on at that time?
It was totally just a pretext to listen to Orson Welles now. So War of the Worlds was broadcast, of course, on Halloween in 1938. And Welles has offered many explanations over his lifetime for why he did it. But the one I believe, and I choose to believe, is that Welles was actually genuinely concerned about the possibilities that radio could be used for nefarious purposes. That if you think about what the implications are of a technology of communications, radio is invasive. Like it's this voice in your kitchen coming out of your living room. It's incredibly intimate, and the very the term fake news comes out of the 1930s because it's what Americans and the British, what's what the Allies called Nazi radio broadcasts on shortwave radio. They broadcast these English language news reports that were just a bunch of lies. They broadcast them all over North and South America. And there was a lot of stuff on the radio. There was Father Coughlin. There's a lot of nuttiness from Huey Long. There's a lot of stuff that you should be really suspicious of on the radio. And Wells was kind of interested in saying, here's actually another obligation of living in a democracy. You have to actually be careful where you're getting your information. You have to have a critical apparatus around it.
And that's a lesson we're still struggling with, it seems. Jill, one thing that surprises me, you wrote about the Democracy Index, which rates the nations of the world on just how democratic they are, right down to the bottom of the list where North Korea is. But the U.S. isn't doing so great in recent years. Why not? What are the factors that go into a country's rating in the Democracy Index?
Yeah, it's this, I mean, you can, I guess people try to measure anything. And but there was a kind of concern. This Democracy Index was started by a think tank, I think, associated with The Economist magazine. As an expression of concern for the seeming fragility of democracies around the world, that would be something that would be worth paying attention to. So there's a whole series of measures that go into it, having to do with voter turnout or having to do with do people show up, even kind of congressional turnout, legislative turnout. Are laws being passed or are laws being vetoed? How is the press free? Is there censorship? And unsurprisingly, when the Democracy Index started, the United States was one of the stronger democracies, rated as a full democracy. According to this index, the United States first fell out of that top tier category in 2016 and became a flawed democracy. And every year since 2016, the U.S. rating has been worse. So two things seem to be true from this evidence, right? That the number of democracies around the world has been dwindling. And then in the case of the United States has become significantly less democratic.
So we chalk that off to Donald Trump. What are the factors that have made us dip?
I guess I just think that stuff that's been going on with the growing power of the presidency as against the other branches of government goes pretty far back. I mean, it certainly goes back to Nixon.
That's for sure.
I can't see a Hillary Clinton White House having turned that around and ceded power back to Congress, for instance. The increasing politicization of the Supreme Court is something that, I mean, I would date to really Reagan's Justice Department and Reagan's appointments. I guess conservatives would look at that differently, but you know, people would date that to the Warren Court, say. Those are things that are making our system of government not work as it was designed.
And increasing income inequality, which precedes Trump, and it's just only been exacerbated, but it's not all on him. I take your point completely. It just seems that since 2016, in rhetoric and in action, the individual has made a difference. I'm not saying he's the everything and the be-all, and there weren't factors before, and it will probably outlive him.
Outlive him. But, I mean, I don't know. I put a chart on the screen in a class that has income inequality, polarization charted from 1945 to 2016, and we get where we get based on changes that start in 1968. So, yes, you can follow that chart from 2016 to 2020, and things look worse. But it's a long-term, those are long-term trends.
Your piece fairly yearns for, calls for the modern equivalent somehow of town halls, radio plays, public forums, the kind of thing we were discussing before. How would you see that taking place in the world that you know of, the university, of social media, of the technologies that we have available? Is it even possible? What would it look like?
I'm sure that it actually does take place in all kinds of ways. I mean, I spend a fair amount of time going to K-12 schools and meeting with kids and watching them debate stuff or argue over things. I think there's a lot more of that going on than we might perceive. I don't think you can really track it going on social media because it's just not conducive it's not conducive as a format to the kind of careful, deliberative listening that you can imagine. But I think it actually goes on all the time in classrooms. Like I went to my city council, to a city council meeting this year, and I was like, all right, democracy is still working. But you kind of have to get into a room with people.
So I want to go back to your piece. You write about a series that ran in 1937 in the New Republic, where editors asked each writer, a series of writers, whether they thought political democracy was on the wane. And you describe the answer given by the Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce. And Italy at that point was living under fascism. So what did Croce say?
He objected to the question the way a good philosopher should. And he just objected to the passive framing of the question. Because he's like, his thing was, all right, politics and government is not like the weather. Like, we don't just, like, you're asking me basically a meteorological question, like, what's the weather look like? It's not the weather. We control politics and government. So you don't ask people, what's the weather going to be like? You ask people, how are you going to go out and change the weather? What are you going to do? You don't just sit around, like, trying to decide, do I need an umbrella today? You actually go out and change the weather. And that's what I think people had a sense of needing to urgently do in the 1930s. And we do have a kind of different sensibility. I don't know, in the quarters that I inhabit, there's a lot of political despair. It's a fashionable political despair. It's almost like a fetish for political despair.
Is it a reasonable political despair?
Seriously? No, I don't actually think it is. I really don't. Because, look, before 1965, we didn't even have voting rights in this country. Like, what is the past that you think was so infinitely better than this moment? It's easy to take democracy for granted when things are going fairly well. And when you watch democratic institutions being jeopardized and when you watch abuses of power and authority, it casts your attention and your concern into really stark light. And those conversations that you have about what's going on are what actually restores the democracy. They are what rekindles those traditions, what defends those institutions, and what renews the democracy itself.
Jill Lepore is a staff writer for The New Yorker. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for being with us, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.